It is indeed both a pleasure and an honor to be back here. I was just reminiscing there with Maureen Cassidy that I think the last time I was in this building would have been for a meeting of the Medieval Society with somebody like Ludwig Bieler, who had done his best work probably in the 20s, and it makes you feel a little bit, you're in touch with history here, let's say. It is nice to be back under the auspices of UCD, but the occasion, I must say, would not have been complete without the representation of a figure most associated with Trinity College, who has been my great friend here in Ireland for many years. But lest we get carried away any further with this kind of thing, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found a little bit over 60 years ago. Different accounts put it in late 46 or early 47. Shortly after I was born, actually. It was highly providential. But the first ones were found in a cave, a kilometre or a little more than a kilometre away from the Dead Sea and away from the site of Qumran, which is the place most associated with them. And the initial finds were of well-preserved scrolls in jars that included the rule for a religious community. And, you know, anyone who ever lived in a religious community would have to be struck by the similarity, down to how you should behave yourself at a meeting of the community, the penalty if you should guffaw during a meeting, or fall asleep, or weren't dressed properly, or any of these things, and some theological stuff besides. But in any case, that was probably the document that caught people's eye most. Now, already in the first press release about them in April of 1948, the press release said that this seemed to be the rule for a monastic community, possibly the Jewish sect of the Essenes. Now, that was a conclusion that people reached very fast and that stuck. And I'd say still sticks to a great degree, but has become a little bit more controversial in recent times. Now, there was, and had all long known, there's already a well-known site there by the Dead Sea, the ruins of Qumran. It was thought to be the ruins of an ancient military fort. And initially, the people who examined the scrolls did not make a connection with that site. But then they thought that they ought to check that site out and went and excavated it. And when they dug it up, they found fragments of the same kind of jars. And many of you may have seen pictures of these jars, even if you're not particularly students of ancient Judaism. The very tall jars that seemed to be made just for the purpose of putting scrolls in them. And then when they found fragments of these on the actual site, this seemed to kind of give grounds to think that the community described in the community rule was one that had lived at that site. And as we'll come back to this in a few minutes, a passage in that community rule actually said that when these things happen, you shall go into the wilderness to prepare the way of the Lord, and this would seem to be where they went. In the wilderness. Then a couple of years after that, in 1954, Cave 4 at Qumran was discovered. I should probably have also copied pictures. There's a famous picture of Qumran, of a promontory like a lion's claw that sticks out towards the Dead Sea. And out on one of the fingers, if we may call it that, of the lion's claw, there is a little hole, and that was K4. And in that cave, there were fragments of some 700 or 800 manuscripts found. Now, this was literally a stone's throw from the ruins. The ruins, by the way, had turned out to be some kind of community dwelling, too big to be a private residence. with some large public rooms that were identified at the time by Roland de Vaux, who was a Dominican priest, called one of them the refectory. This is what one would call the dining hall in a religious community. And he did so for a perfectly good reason, that in a little room off it, there were hundreds of bowls that had been destroyed in an earthquake. And that seemed to be the pantry. Then there was another room identified as the scriptorium, because there were two or three inkwells found in it. And there's a long-standing controversy as to how significant is it if you find two or three inkwells. Well, some people would say two or three inkwells, well, so what? But then these things are metal, and metal objects tend to get picked up over the years, and the wonder is that they found any of them at all. And then just beside the ruins, there was a cemetery with 1,100 to 1,200 graves. They've been counted many times. I don't think any two people have ever come up with the same exact number of graves, but it's in that ballpark. And most of them laid out very carefully. Now, I'll come back to that too, because one of the controversies about this cemetery, which is really just another stone's throw away from the site. If you look actually at the picture of the ruin here, you can see the lion's claw out here, where K4 is, where most of the manuscripts were hidden. And you see, you couldn't get to it without going through this community. And so the belief arose that this must have been the library of the community, where they kept all their scrolls. Then over here a little bit, am I turned around on that? No, it's over here a little bit towards the Dead Sea is this huge cemetery with all these graves very neatly laid out. And then when a sampling of them were excavated, and very few female skeletons were found. Now, a few were. How many? Again, this is a controversial question, and I'll come back to it a little bit later. But the few that were clearly identified as such were out on the edges of the cemetery. It might remind you of the cemetery in Maynooth, where again you will get women buried around the edges, but not in the central core of the cemetery. And this added to the impression that this was indeed a religious institution. Now, the rule of the community, the document known as Serek HaYachad in Hebrew, never mentions women or children, which is an extraordinary thing. There are other texts found at Qumran that do mention women and children, but this rule doesn't. And again, what significance you attach to that is an open question. Do you conclude from that it was a celibate community? Or not. Now, so from a very early point then in the 1950s, a consensus developed that the Dead Sea Scrolls were the library of a religious community that lived at Qumran by the Dead Sea. And if you look on the other side here, you can see where Jerusalem is. Nowadays it takes about 20 minutes to half an hour to drive from Jerusalem to Qumran. And again, there is a controversy. Was this a remote location? It isn't nowadays. Nowadays, if you go there, there's sure to be a bus or two pulled up, and there's a visitor centre. But of course, in antiquity, it was wilderness. And now, you know, somebody came up with the idea 15 years ago that Qumran was a luxury villa. And this caused hilarity, I would say, in the scholarly community. Who in their right mind would want to build a luxury villa down by the Dead Sea? Hotter than hell and drier. And so I think that one can probably be safely discounted. Now, one possible explanation that seemed certainly has seemed viable to a lot of people is that it was a site of a religious community picked for its remote location in the wilderness. So it mightn't be remote in terms of miles from Jerusalem or Jericho, but it was really in a different kind of space entirely. Okay, so this is the consensus that developed. The consensus then also would identify this community with people known as the Essenes. The historian Josephus, dearly beloved of Sean here, gives us a classic account of three or four, if you count the Zealots, Jewish sects, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. And as he describes the Essenes, they were indeed, to a great degree, a monastic-style community. And we also have some accounts of them by Philo, a Jewish philosopher of around the time of Christ, and Pliny the Elder, who was a Roman antiquarian who died in the eruption of Vesuvius. He was an antiquarian, he just got too curious, he couldn't get away from an interesting happening like that. And he mentions the Essenes, and he mentions that they live without money and without any women. Josephus also mentions, and by the way, there is another order of Essenes who do marry, because they thought it would be a shame to let the human race entirely die out. Not indeed that their celibacy would have had that effect. But in any case, these were the elements of the consensus. Now, from already a fairly early point in the 1950s, it was observed that there were, to begin with, that this community rule had a lot in common with another document that had been found in the Cairo Geniza in the 1890s. And this described the new covenant in the land of Damascus. And so it became known as the Damascus Document. Now, there were several things in common between that document and this community rule found at Qumran. Damascus Document refers to a figure called the Teacher of Righteousness. And while he isn't mentioned in the community rule, he was found in other documents at Qumran, and he was associated with the Yachad, which is the technical name for this community. Then his opponent was known as the Man of the Lie, and they mention the sons of Zadok, and the sons of Zadok also come up a lot in the community rule and so forth. So there was obviously some relationship here. Also in the manner in which they were organized. But while there was obviously some relationship, they weren't quite the same thing. In the Damascus document, you have essentially a family-based organization. It says, if they live in camps according to the order of the land and marry and have children, then they shall do X, Y, and Z. Now, a man is supposed to enroll his son in this organization, which they call the congregation, the Ada. And so when a son comes to a certain age, the man and his son are to take an oath. And the way they join the organization is simply by taking an oath. Then we're told that they are to contribute 2 days' wages every month to the upkeep of the community. This, if you like, was the assessment that you might pay in a co-op building, you know, for the common needs, but also for the care of the aged and the infirm in the community. So they did have wives, they did have children, they did have funds from which they could contribute money, so they did have some private property, but they did have a common fund like that. There were other restrictions then on what they could do. You couldn't marry without the permission of the overseer of the congregation. And equally, worse perhaps, you couldn't get divorced without the permission of the overseer of the congregation. Other copies of this Damascus rule were found at Qumran in K4. And these included some additional regulations that weren't in the copy that had been found in the Cairo Geniza. They included, for example, penalties for somebody who fornicated with his wife. And now it doesn't specify, how do you fornicate with your wife? It evidently wasn't forbidding all sexual intercourse, but probably by having intercourse, in certain periods of impurity, but there was some regulation on it at any rate. And, of course, you would also want to know, how would the supervisor know whether somebody had fornicated with his wife? And evidently he had some way of finding out, or thought he had, or maybe he figured it was enough to put the fear of God into people. So you get in this Damascus document then one kind of community. It is, if you like, a lay order, where people can live in different groups. They are supposed to cluster together. You get provision for gatherings of at least 10 people. You also get then rules for the assembly of all the camps. So they have a general assembly once a year, perhaps, and at which they renew their covenant. It becomes clear enough from reading it why they felt the need to do this. It was all about one's understanding of what the Jewish law required. And these people figured that the rest of the society wasn't doing this right. They didn't have the right interpretations. And there is a passage where they talk about these other people of whom everyone marries his niece or his nephew. Well, now surely not everybody married his niece or his nephew, but evidently they thought it was permissible. And look, matters of this sort, a lot of them having to do with degrees of purity, the observance of the festivals, and it becomes clear enough from other texts found at Qumran, the calendar was a big deal, that they had a different cultic calendar. Now, if you're observing the Day of Atonement on a different day from the rest of society, this is a bit awkward. And if you figure the chief priest in the temple in Jerusalem is getting it wrong and doing it wrong, then it just becomes insufferable and you got to pack your goods and move out. And this evidently was what gave rise to this movement. So, not quite monastic, but definitely separatist, and fair enough, I think, to call it sectarian. Now, in the community rule found at Qumran, however, the breach is a bit further than this. In this case, there is no mention of women. It's very hard, actually, to write an 11-column document without mentioning women at all. But that's what they do there. So no mention of women. It's quite specific that when you join the congregation, this organization, you hand over all your money. The person to whom you hand it over is supposed to put it aside and not use it for the purposes of the congregation, at least until you're fully merged, as they say. And in one passage, then, they say that in order to join, you swear an oath. In another passage, it goes on to say, well, that isn't enough. And they describe a 3-year postulancy. So that, you're in for a year before, and I'm not doing this part of it from memory, and I forget which is which, but after 1 year you're allowed to participate in the food of the community, and after another year then in the drink of the community. But gradual admission. And only after 3 years of being tested do you become a full member. Now, also the Damascus document had problems, had issues with the people in the temple. That much is clear enough. And it says that you shouldn't woe on those who open the door of the temple to worship in my temple in vain. Now, in the community rule, they say nothing really about the temple, but they say the community is the temple. That they are to separate from the people of evil, and when they do so, they will make atonement for the land. In other words, they will do what the temple ought to do. It's like it's a replacement temple. So it's a more severe degree of separation. How is one to explain the relationship between these two rules? For a while, some people suggested that the the community rule, the stricter one came first, and that then they mellowed a little bit and started to allow some marriage and the like. Most of us nowadays, though, think it was probably the other way round, that they started out gradually, contributing, say, 2 days' earnings a month, and that then, when they weren't getting anywhere with the people in the temple, they decided this isn't enough, we've got to break with these people completely and set up a completely rival kind of society. And I think, you know, you can see then how you start out where you only require people to swear an oath, but then after a while you require a whole 3 years postulancy. And I should say this 3 years postulancy is very similar to what Josephus says the Essenes required, and that was one of the main links that led to the identification. Now, Josephus also says that the Essenes had common property and that they lived without women. Now, if you add up all the groups that we know of for whom these things were true in ancient Judaism, common property, no mention of women, and the like, you arrive at a total of two, or one, depending on whether the Essenes and these people are the same. So, you know, if they weren't the same people, they sure were a lot like them. Now, so far, so good, I think, with this the relation between the two. It is not the case that they started out with the Damascus rule and then became more strict and abandoned the first one. Rather, it seems to be the case that both went on side by side then for a period of time, because we have several copies of both of these rules, and they seem to have been copied over as much as 100 years. So evidently you have two forms of the organization going on more or less together. Now, I think a lot of people would agree with everything I've said up to this point, and would then take the further step of saying, and that then the people of the Yakad, the people of the stricter kind of organization, they were the people who lived at Qumran. And this, I would submit, will not quite do. And my reason for saying that it will not quite do is one passage in column 6 of that community rule that goes like this. These are the ways in which all of them shall walk, each man with his companion, wherever they dwell. The man of lesser rank shall obey the greater in matters of work and money. They shall eat in common, and bless in common, and deliberate in common. Doesn't actually say how often they shall eat in common, but it doesn't give you the impression that they ever go off and eat on their own. So it requires at least people who live pretty close to each other, some kind of community structure. Then, wherever there are 10 men of the council of the community, there shall not lack a priest among them. The council of the community is just another way of saying the community. The two expressions are interchangeable. And they shall all sit before him according to their rank, and shall be asked their counsel in all things in that order. And when the table has been prepared for eating and the new wine for drinking, the priest shall be the first to stretch out his hand to bless the fruits of the wine, bread and the new wine. Wherever the 10 are, there shall never lack among them a man who shall study the law continually day and night, and the congregation shall watch in community for a third of every night of the year to read the book and study the law. So, what constitutes a community? I think that passage is quite clear. You need a quorum of 10, what modern Jews would call a minyan. And where you have 10, there you have a council of the Yachad, if you like. Now, what that means, I think quite clearly, is that Qumran may have been a site where you had a council of the Yachad, but it wasn't the only one. That rather what you had here was a community that was spread throughout the country and had many groups with a minimum of 10 members. And then the Yakad, the association on the whole, was kind of an umbrella organization for these different groups. This, in fact, would be very continuous then with what you had in the Damascus document, except that the groups of 10 here evidently did not marry and have children. This was no longer part of the deal. So that, I think, this also, I should say, would agree with what Josephus says about the Essenes, that they lived not in any one place, lived in no one city, but that in every city they had communities. So what that means then is that the site of Qumran in itself maybe isn't all that important for it. It was at most one of many settlements of this organization that was spread throughout the land. Okay, was there then any mention of Qumran at all in the sectarian literature? Well, there's one passage that has often been cited in that regard. This is in column 8 of the same community rule. In the council of the community there shall be 12 men and 3 priests, perfectly versed in all that is revealed of the law, whose work shall be truth, righteousness, justice, loving kindness, and humility. Now, actually, these 12 men and 3 priests are a bit of a problem. There is only one other passage that refers to 15 men, and that's out of context. It's only a fragment. So we don't really know who they were. When these are in Israel, the council of the community shall be established in truth. And when they have been confirmed in for 2 years in perfection of the way, in the foundation of the community, they shall be set apart as holy within the council of the men of the community. And the interpreter shall not conceal from them, out of fear of the spirit of apostasy, any of those things hidden from Israel that have been discovered by him. So the boss is going to tell them everything. And it's clear from that that you didn't tell all members everything. And when these become members of the community in Israel, according to all these rules, they shall separate from the habitation of unjust men and go into the wilderness to prepare there the way of him, as it is written, prepare in the wilderness the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a path for our God. This is the study of the law which he commanded by the hand of Moses. Now, a lot of people think that that is referring to the first members of the Qumran community. Now, it may be, or it may not be. It's clear enough that when it says, shall go into the wilderness, it's using that symbolically. It's to go into the wilderness means to study the law. But the fact that it's symbolic doesn't mean that it couldn't also be literal. And it would be all the more apt if they actually did go into the wilderness to study the law. So, you know, it remains a possibility, but not really provable. Now, some people have the idea that the people who went to Qumran just broke away from the rest of the organization. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. That the people who go into the wilderness presuppose a larger community where somebody singled them out as promising candidates, took them aside, taught them everything, didn't hold anything back from them, and then sent them off. So they seem to be an elite group that's to be set aside as a kind of capstone to this community. What they do is much the same as what the rest of the community does, only they're supposed to do it more perfectly. Now, so that's the kind of community that's envisioned there. Now, we don't know whether these 12 men and 3 priests ever actually existed, whether this was just an ideal, or whether, in fact, they did go off and start a community in the wilderness, and if they did do it at Qumran, then the numbers must have grown at some point down the line. But that is the only reference in the sectarian literature that could possibly refer to the site of Qumran. Now, before I turn then to talk a little bit about the actual site, there is the question of when did all this happen? Well, people date the scrolls on the basis of the handwriting. This is a little bit risky because we don't have all that much well-dated handwriting from the period, but we have some inscriptions, and now we have some dated documents. You can establish pretty well what went before them and what came after them. And most people would agree that these documents mostly come from the first century before Christ. That's where most of them were written, some of them perhaps in the first century after the turn of the era. So that's the general ballpark. There is only one passage in the scrolls themselves that seems to give a story of how they came about. And that's in the first column of the Damascus document. And it talks about how God delivered Israel into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. This was the Babylonian exile, which began in 586, a well-known event. And then it says that in the age of wrath, he visited them 390 years after he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. So some people would subtract 390 years from 586, which would get you down into the 2nd century BC, to the beginning of the 2nd century BC. But the problem is, everyone agrees that 390 years are symbolic, like a lot of the stuff that we deal with, and that the symbolic numbers is taken from the book of Ezekiel, where he tells the prophet to lie on one side for 390 days, one day for each year of the punishment of Israel. And now, whether then you can actually deduce anything from that chronologically is very much an open question. I'd say the consensus view on it massaged the number a little bit, because some of the other documents found at Qumran are biblical commentaries, and they describe a conflict between the teacher of righteousness and the wicked priest. Now, the wicked priest was evidently the high priest of the day. And so people said, now, when would you have had a sectarian leader turning against the high priest? And somebody came up with the idea that after the Maccabean revolt, which happened in 167 to 164 BC, the old high priestly line was disrupted. The high priest was murdered. His son went off to Egypt. These were Zadokite priests. And the people at Qumran talk a lot about Zadokites. And then, after a gap, the Maccabees decided, well, we'll be the high priests. And there were some people who didn't like that. They said these people were not from the proper priestly line, and therefore they said maybe that's why they thought this high priest was a wicked priest, and this is why they turned against them. Well, you know, in theory, this was possible. The first Maccabee to become high priest did so in the year 152. And they said, well, you know, that's close enough. It's supposed to have taken them about 20 years anyway before the teacher came along. So maybe they didn't get it quite right with the 390 years, but if you push it down a little bit, it'll do. And then when they excavated Qumran, well, they found a lot of coins from the early 1st century BC, and a few from before that. And so they said, well, that'll fit if they started this place up somewhere around 150. But there were a lot of assumptions in that. And in fact, I don't think those hold up, because the 390 years doesn't mean anything, really, in terms of actual years. Nobody really knew, I think, in ancient Judaism how long it had been since the Babylonian exile. In Daniel, they estimate the period from the Babylonian exile to the Maccabean revolt was 490 years, which is way off. And I don't think you can put any weight on the 390 years either. And then it turns out later that this sect did not start because of a quarrel with the priesthood. And even in the biblical commentaries, they never say that this priest didn't have a right to be high priest. What they do, that do constantly complain about, is that they weren't interpreting the law correctly, and they didn't have the proper calendar, and it was issues like this that led to the break. Now, a very important text came to light in 1984. It's in the trade, we call it 4QMMT. Some of the commands of the Torah. And this was a document evidently sent by a sectarian leader to a leader in Israel, presumably a high priest, saying these are the reasons for which we have separated from the majority of the people. And most of them had to do with issues of purity. For example, if you pour water from one vessel into another, and the vessel you're pouring it into is unclean, does the impurity travel upstream and mean that what was left in the bottle is now unclean as well? This is not the kind of thing most modern people get excited about. But there were people for whom this was a matter of life and death. These were the minute, the fine points of the religious law. And that is the kind of thing that gave rise to the split. I think, actually, we can get a much more plausible date for the actual split. A bit later, about 75 BC, and we know, again, from our friend Josephus, that Alexander Janneus, who was the king for the first quarter of that century, didn't get along with the Pharisees, and at one point crucified 800 of them. But then, when he was on his deathbed, he said to his wife, who would then be queen, "You know, you should make peace with the Pharisees. It just isn't worth it," in effect. And so she did. And so they switched their legal observance from what would have been basically the law of the Sadducees to the law of the Pharisees. And we know from this MMT that the sect of Qumran followed much the same version of the law as the Sadducees. And so so that, I think, was probably the occasion when they decided they just couldn't get along any longer with the high priest in Jerusalem. But let me come for a few minutes here to the actual site of Qumran. Now, if you look at it here, the thing I think that would strike a casual observer most, first of all, there is a tower here. There is a fortification here in the middle of the picture. And this would have been a tower. This is the only part of the structure that could have been defended. And there was a kind of ramp up against it to strengthen the walls. Then you have a network of rooms, but you also have 10 or 11 large cisterns. Now, you also see here on the site there's a channel that would have collected the rainwater off the cliff, and this would have gone into the various pools. Now, of course, if you're going to live down by the Dead Sea, you're going to need a lot of water, and you'd expect any group to live that would live there to have a number of cisterns. But there are about 10 or 11 of these that have steps going down into them. And that is unusual if you're just collecting the water. In some of them, there was a divider on the steps so that you could go down one side and come up the other. And all of this strongly suggests that these were immersion pools for purposes of purification. And so one of the questions about the site is what kind of a group would have needed that many immersion pools? Now, I'll come back to that in a second. What are the possible explanations of this site? Because this has become a raging controversy now over the last 15 years or so, starting with the people who suggested that this was really a luxury villa. And that one got pretty well laughed out of court. But the more serious proposal, I think, was that it could have been a military fort. Now, again, if you look at the picture here, you can identify more or less a square building at the middle of it with this fort at the corner. And some people would say that was the original structure. And then it was expanded and it sprawled out from there. I'm not sure that that's actually right, because one of these pools over here is thought to be one of the, you know, that in any case there had been an older structure there which was a military fort, 500 or 600 years earlier. Then it was re-inhabited in the 2nd century or the 1st century of before the Common Era. And at that point they took over some things from the old fortification. The trouble is, we don't know exactly just when the different parts of it were built. And when it was excavated in the 50s, they didn't do the kind of foundation trenches, or at least they didn't save enough information from them, to make it possible to say that this bit was built 50 years after that bit. And so that becomes a bit uncertain. I do think, though, that there is some plausibility to the idea that it was at one time a military fort. And that you can see by looking at the map on the back. Because, no, this is an aspect of it. This gets into the ecology, you see. And Sean actually knows a lot more about this than I do, and he's just been around there. He's freshly back from inspecting some of these sites. But if you look just where Qumran is, and you look a little bit north of it, you have Jericho, Dock, and Cyprus. Now, these were fortresses built by the Hasmoneans, who were the descendants of the Maccabees. Hyrcania was another one. And then across the Dead Sea, you had Machaerus, which was another one. In other words, the Hasmoneans had built a ring of fortresses around the top of the Dead Sea. And there you have Qumran sitting in the middle of them. Now, it's clear enough from the scrolls that the people of the Yakad did not get along with the Hasmoneans. And they complain at one point that the wicked priest had tried to kill the teacher of righteousness. Now, you would figure if the high priest wanted to kill the teacher, why would he let him have a site that's sitting here in the middle of a ring of Hasmonean fortresses? And so I think, you know, there is some force to that argument, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's very hard to believe that these scrolls didn't belong to the people who lived at the site. Now, the scrolls, it should be said, are not a random sampling of what would have been Jewish literature at the time. They have a high proportion of specifically sectarian documents, and then they don't have anything that you could describe as pro-Hasmonean. You don't have anything that you could describe as pro-Pharisee. So it's a selected body of literature. Not all of it written by the sect necessarily, but certainly excluding some things and including others. So it is a sectarian collection, and if indeed that collection belonged to the people who lived at the site, then I think it would follow that at some point it was a sectarian settlement. But in the middle of the first century before Christ, big things happened in Jerusalem. The biggest of these, in all probability, was that the Roman general Pompey came to Jerusalem. He had been settling up affairs around the Near East after clearing out the pirates. And there was a squabble going on in Jerusalem between two claimants to the throne. And they invited Pompey to come and arbitrate. And the upshot of it was that Pompey took over Jerusalem and put an end to the Hasmonean dynasty. This happened in 63 BC. So that at that point, the Hasmoneans suddenly lost their control of all of this region. And it becomes much more credible that a religious group would have moved in, I think, after that point. Also, Herod was supposed to have been friendly to the Essenes when he came to power, and again, he mightn't have minded there. So I think there's something to be said for the idea that Qumran was actually built as a kind of lookout post by the Hasmoneans. It wasn't strong enough to be a real fortress, but it could have been a lookout post, which was then taken over afterwards by the Essenes or whoever these people were from this religious community. Actually, the most most authoritative account of the archaeology of Qumran is not this book that we have here on the table, but it's written by a woman named Jodie Magnus, and she says that the date of the settlement could have been anywhere between 100 and 50 BC. So, I mean, if she's right, the whole thing actually could have been built after the Hasmoneans had already fallen from power. I think it's more likely that there already was something there. But I think that is a real possibility. I don't think it's something that can be proven, actually. You'd have to be able to say that this part was built. The Hasmoneans would not have had 11 purification pools on the site. So really the crucial question is when all these were dug. And we don't really know that in any scientific way. But I think there's a real possibility that there was at one point a military fort there that was then later taken over by a religious community. A final point, were they the Essenes? And why should it matter? I think why should it matter is how odd a group of people do you think these were? If you want to say these were not particularly odd, they were more like mainstream Jews, then it becomes important to say that they weren't Essenes. But it seems to me quite clear they were a very odd group of people. And if they weren't the Essenes, they were the next oddest group of people around, because they have a lot of things in common that you don't find with anybody else. It was not normal practice in ancient Judaism to have common property, or to abstain from marriage, or even to live in community the way these people evidently did, and the Essenes are also said to have done. Now, one of the persistent problems, is that the scrolls never say, and you must be celibate to join. In that community route, they just don't mention women at all. Some people would say, if you want people to be celibate, you need to be explicit. And you can cite examples from other Christian sects that introduced a requirement of celibacy and, you know, didn't leave any doubt about it. But then it is, to my mind, equally odd not to mention women at all. So I think that in all probability, there was a celibate branch of this movement. It may have been the smaller branch, but I think it probably was. And that would be one big point then affecting whether you think they were the same as the Essenes. It is also true that the accounts of the Essenes never mention messiahs or a war against the sons of darkness, apocalyptic ideas. In fact, I wouldn't want to disappoint Sean by not mentioning the word at all. But I think you can understand that the Greek accounts that we have in Josephus and Philo were written for outsiders. And Josephus wanted to present the Jews in a good light. And he didn't want people to think that they were crazies who were planning a war against Rome or a war against the sons of darkness, and that these things were left out for a reason. So I do think that it is still much more probable that they were the Essenes rather than having to invent a whole other Jewish sect for whom we have no other evidence. So that is my little survey of current issues relating to Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls. If any of you have any questions of any sort, I would be most happy to entertain them.